Let me get then to the meat of our gathering today. And we are especially favored because Ambassador Kurtzer has just returned from the area he's going to talk about. He landed in New York, returning from Israel, at 4:30 this morning. And he has come to be with us today, which is remarkably friendly of him to our class, and I certainly appreciate that enormously, which means, of course, that he has a very recent feel for the place. But, you know, I was thinking this morning about the problem challenge in that area, and I just looked at several things that came to my attention, that maybe the most important thing is that Pakistan has banned Valentine's Day, as you may have read. And then Prime Minister Netanyahu has been accused of bribery. The bribery allegation will probably make a big difference in politics there. A peace plan apparently is being developed in Washington absolutely without the intervention of the State Department, which is a remarkable circumstance as well, that on the Sinai, Egypt is attempting to defeat ISIS with the wrong weapons, and that the Cossacks have now been set upon the Kurds, which I think will be fascinating. And in Syria, it seems to me that we're looking at a sort of military monopoly game. It's a very difficult part of the world, but we are going to learn a great deal more about it today. It's a great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Ambassador Daniel Kurtzer.
I want to thank you for the invitation to join you, and Mr. Marks actually stole one of the things I wanted to say initially, which was one of my reasons for coming was to meet you and to hear about all of the distinguished things that you've done with your life as Princeton alumni. So thank you for that opportunity. I also want to shout out a particular hello to a colleague and friend of many years, Ambassador Robert Pelletreau, who's here as a guest of one of your classmates. Bob has had a distinguished, really notable career as ambassador in Bahrain, Tunisia, and one of my predecessors in Cairo. And we spent some time back in, I guess it was 1988-89, on the phone almost every day at the beginning of what was then the US-PLO dialogue. If you allow, it just reminds me of a story which some of you may be familiar with, of the man who survived the Johnstown flood. And he was trying to figure out what to do with the rest of his life, and he decided that he would undertake a speaking career to talk about the Johnstown flood, and he spent the next 25, 30 years doing that. When his time came and he approached the gates of heaven, an angel came to him and said, "You're quite welcome, except that one of the requirements before you enter is that you've got to give a speech about something that's been important in your life." So the man said, "Well, look, I survived the Johnstown flood. I made a career of speaking about it. So I'm going to talk about the Johnstown flood." And the angel said, "Well, it's okay to talk about that flood, but just remember that the biblical Noah is in the audience." So, Bob, you'll excuse whatever mistakes I made. I do want to talk today about the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian-Israeli peace process, but more than just that particular issue, I want to put it in a context. And one of the main takeaways of this afternoon's conversation is going to be the fact that we have an administration that simply is not doing its homework, either in understanding the context in which this peace process is supposed to take place or doing the hard work of understanding the peace process itself. And so I've done a few slides just for entertainment purposes, but I'll explicate them in the course of our conversation. You recall that on the couple days after the election in 2016, the president gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal and surprised everyone by saying that he was going to elevate the Arab-Israeli conflict to the top of his agenda, and he was going to do the ultimate deal that no one else could do. Only he could do it. And by so doing, he not only gave it increased prominence, but he also then put it out as a challenge. All of his predecessors had tried, and he was going to achieve it. He appointed his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, among the many other hats that Kushner was asked to wear. He asked Kushner to be in charge of running this peace process. And the expectations then became quite high. One of the things that might have been expected of Kushner and the very small team that he assembled was that they would try to understand the region in which this process was supposed to take place, as well as the particular issues involved. Just to take one example, Middle East is a place, many of you know this, Bob and I have lived it, in which conflict has been endemic, persistent. When one conflict seems to come to an end, another starts. Very few conflicts get resolved. They go into a state of dormancy. But this chart, which is a little bit hard to see, but I'm going to share this presentation on your website so you can do homework after I'm finished, suggests how high the cost of conflict has been in the Middle East. And in fact, this issue has prompted my teaching at Princeton every couple of years of doing a course at the Woodrow Wilson School on the effect of diplomacy on protracted conflicts, in which we put the two issues together. We study the typology and variety of conflicts, both internal and external. We study the variety of diplomatic interventions. The students are asked to do case studies of a protracted conflict, and then we try to draw lessons out of those case studies of whether or not diplomacy can be effective. So far, we haven't had any success in drawing out positive implications, but we keep trying. We have about 40 case studies that have now been accumulated. The point is that conflict itself in the Middle East has taken a tremendous toll, and particularly today, to ask Israelis and Palestinians to engage in a peace process which will involve, certainly on the Israeli side, very significant strategic concessions, giving up territory, giving up what they believe might be more defensible borders that they've had since 1967, these issues raise very significant challenges for a peacemaker. And if you don't understand those challenges, you walk in and say, well, this is just another deal. You know, I'm going to buy a property on Fifth Avenue and let's just find out what the price is. Let alone when you look at some of the other issues in the Middle East. Again, it's a complicated chart. You can look at it later in more detail. But this is a region that has been beset by abnormal problems related to corruption and crony capitalism, to population growth that in itself has caused very difficult challenges of food security and education, jobs, finding employment for populations that are exploding. I don't remember back in the time that Bob was ambassador. I served in Cairo actually back in the late 1970s in my first overseas assignment. And at that time, the population of Egypt, for example, was about 35 million people. Roy Atherton, who was our ambassador, invited an American demographic expert to come to Cairo and to talk to President Anwar Sadat about population problems and the impact that those would have. And this population expert suggested to Sadat that if Egypt could achieve zero population growth the next day, the population of Egypt would rise to about 60 million people over the next 20 years. I mean, that's the nature of the population, the demographic cycle. And of course, if it didn't reach zero population growth the next day, which was obvious it wasn't going to, the explosion would be really untold. And right now, the population of Egypt is probably approaching about 100 million and is taxing every conceivable capability that society has. The one that I focused on some when I was serving as ambassador was the educational system. We had an education assistance program that focused on classroom size and girls' education. Obviously, you can see the connection between the two. And we were trying to build more schools, improve the quality of the schools, and also to encourage the schools to provide education for girls. By the time I arrived, we had invested $750 million in this effort. And when I asked our AID director for the metrics by which to measure success, The answer was there was no success. Classroom size had continued to grow because of the population growth, and there were no greater numbers of girls in the educational system. Cairo University, another area that people have always looked at, one of the great universities in the Middle East, was built for probably 25 or 30,000 students. When I was ambassador, and we're now talking almost 20 years ago, there were more than 100,000 students, including, and I know Bill's going to appreciate this, including doctors who graduated almost never having seen the inside of a laboratory, simply because there wasn't space. There wasn't room for all the students that needed to be accommodated. And you go down the list of these issues in the Middle East, and you see how challenging this region is. Problems that don't seem to go away and actually seem to get worse. The region also has experienced a number of shocks, systemic shocks, I would argue, even in the last 25 to 30 years. The first of which may sound a little bit paradoxical, is the end of the Cold War. You know, the international system during the period of U.S.-Soviet confrontation got used to the idea of a bipolar power balance in which small states who were being courted by the two superpowers had actually a significant amount of influence because they could sell their wares to the highest bidder. But the system was fairly well regulated even when regional conflicts broke out. Well, at the end of the 1980s, beginning of 1990, the Cold War came to an end, and it threw the region into a state of acute shock. One of the positive effects of that shock was, as you recall, in 1990 when Iraq invaded Kuwait in August of 1990, the United States under President George H.W. Bush tried to marshal and successfully marshaled an international coalition, both political and military, to push Iraq out of Kuwait. He was able to gain the support of key Arab countries who were ready to fight against another Arab country in order to reverse the aggression. Egypt sent two mechanized divisions to fight alongside the United States. Syria sent a mechanized division to fight alongside the United States. And Saudi Arabia, of course, became the primary basing area for many of the troops in the coalition. So there was a shock to this system, which could have had a beneficial impact, but the system reverted to form, and in fact accommodated itself almost immediately to a unipolar world, but that had little impact on the internal challenges that the region faced. The second shock to the system was the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. Talked a little bit about it while we were having lunch, where the United States then became a prime factor in increasing the dislocations within the system, trying to bring about democratic change in an Iraqi society that's very complex, not easy to understand even for those who think they understand Iraq. But walking in and assuming that we were going to impose a democracy would be welcomed as democratic liberators, and we would do so by dismissing the army and the government, kind of undoing Iraqi society in the hope that it could put itself back together again properly. And here we are, it's 2018, and Iraq is still not put together properly, and our own involvement there continues. And it also has sent a message through the region, which we didn't intend to send, that maybe democracy is not really something that they should be aspiring to. A third shock to the system, of course, were the Arab revolutions of 2011, the so-called Arab Spring. What made that interesting, and there, you know, we could talk only about that for the next couple of hours, but for the purposes of where I want to get to, what made that interesting was the arrival on the scene of a new element in the Middle East, and that was the people. In Egypt, for example, you knew that there were always three power centers. The army, which had effected the 1952 revolution and which had remained a Praetorian body behind the head of state. the bureaucracy, the so-called deep state. Egypt is one of the historical founders of what we call bureaucracy, and the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamic establishment. Muslim Brotherhood was founded in Egypt in 1928 and has always been a factor in Egyptian political life, even when it's been forced underground and wasn't able to play its role openly. Well, in 2011, Tahrir Square was occupied largely by the people. And it was an interesting moment which faded almost immediately, because the people really had no leadership, they had no plan, they had no organization, they had no way of taking what they had accomplished, which was forcing the army to force Mubarak out of power. And you notice what I said, it wasn't the United States that threw Mubarak under the bus, it was the Egyptian army that removed him from power. So they accomplished that purpose and then couldn't do anything with it. And so Egyptian politics are still back in old form of the army and the Muslim Brotherhood and the so-called deep state. And look what happened in the rest of the region. Except for the monarchies, the eight Arab monarchies, and except for a very brief moment in Bahrain, the Arab monarchies basically escaped this Arab uprising. And the republics have all faced challenges to their very survival. Syria, Yemen, Libya, the emergence of this possibility of change has not led in positive directions in a large part of this region. Even in Tunisia, which until recently might have been seen as one of the success stories, as the only success story of the Arab Spring, even in Tunisia there are now very significant challenges to stability, and a question of whether or not it will revert to some previous form. And finally, of course, it was the rise of ISIS as a result of many factors, not the least of which was the breakdown of borders, ungoverned space, the radicalization of militant Islamic movements, and the degree to which, even if today we think we have quote-unquote defeated ISIS, we've defeated a particular group in a particular area, but ISIS is morphing into a lot of other things, just as Al-Qaeda has morphed into a lot of other things. If you want to know why American forces are playing a role in Mali and Nigeria and elsewhere, it's because the ISIS mothership has now sent away to fight elsewhere a lot of smaller organizations that are going to create problems globally for quite some time. So if the president now wants to approach one of these problems in the Middle East, which is Israeli-Palestinian, the question is, okay, let's say he had done his homework about the region, which he didn't. But let's say he had. We'll stipulate that the president either had done homework or had people around him who were doing homework. What did he need to know, or what does he need to know about the peace process? First of all, the president thinks he knows real estate. We know that he doesn't, because he's gone bankrupt, what, five times doing real estate deals. He knows how to market his name, which is not unimportant. But he thinks that he can do this like a real estate deal. And, of course, any conflict is much more than just a problem over territory. There is a territorial component to the Palestinian-Israeli issue, an important territorial component. But you have problems of narrative, of religion, of ideology, of history, of economics, of arguments about whether Israel is a colonial power or a national movement of liberation. You've got a lot of these complex issues that have developed over the course of the modern conflict, going back, let's say, 100 years, 120 years, that make this far more difficult to deal with than simply as a real estate problem. He also needs to understand that there are three conventional ways that people have dealt with this peace process. One has been top-down. It's not listed here because I'm going to get to that later. The top-down approach, which has largely been what we've been doing for the last 25 years, is you bring the Israelis and Palestinians into the room and they are asked to negotiate the issues on the table. Jerusalem settlements, refugees, security, economic issues, the normal components of what would become a peace treaty. It's called top-down because it really is divorced from whatever is underneath it. You have a limited number of negotiators negotiating on key issues without reference in their own respect to what's happening on the ground. So to deal with that, the second approach is bottom-up. While you're trying to do top-down, you have to also improve the situation on the ground. Palestinians are living under occupation. They don't have economic freedoms. There is a certain amount of integration between the Israeli and Palestinian economies, but the key decisions and key policy issues are decided by Israel rather than by Palestinians. And therefore, one of the ways to remedy that might be to empower Palestinians to take some decisions about their life on the ground that would give them confidence that when they do become an independent state, they can actually manage their state and it wouldn't be a failed state. The third way to approach this is outside in. You have a whole Arab world, this region that I just talked about, that's been sitting on the sidelines, mostly doing negative things in the Arab-Israeli peace process, mostly rallying support for opposition to Israel's existence for a long time, boycotts of Israel for a long time, mandating hardline positions in an Arab League that until 20 years ago used to only be able to decide on hardline positions vis-a-vis the peace process. And so you have the possibility of changing that paradigm by bringing the Arab world more closely into the peace process. And in 2002, that possibility actually opened up. Because in 2002, the Arab world, at a summit meeting in Beirut, adopted what has become known as the Arab Peace Initiative. And if you look at that Arab Peace Initiative, if I were to give you a very short headline, it changed the Arab political position from its focus on 1948, which is whether or not Israel should exist as an independent state, to a focus on 1967, whether Israel would give up the territories that it had occupied. Because the basis of that Arab Peace Initiative basically says, if Israel gives up territory and a Palestinian state is created and there are two capitals in Jerusalem and there's agreed resolution of the refugee issue and, a not unreasonable set of principles, the Arab world will recognize Israel and provide it with the security and integration that Israel has long sought, which means that it's no longer a question of the Arabs seeking Israel's destruction, but they do want to see an end of the occupation and the emergence of a Palestinian state. So outside-in approach got a boost in 2002, and nobody did anything with it. I was serving in Israel as ambassador at the time, and there actually was an excuse in 2002 for our not doing anything, because the month of the Arab summit in Beirut was the worst month of the Palestinian Intifada in terms of casualties. There was, on the average, a successful suicide bombing every other day for a month. There were 14, I think, in the month of February of 2002. And so one could not expect that society to absorb political activities going on in Beirut when they were worried about sending their kids off to school and going to a movie or going to a mall or to a restaurant. But the Arabs came back to the initiative in 2007 when there was no Palestinian uprising, no Intifada, and again, nobody paid attention. And I was going to talk about in a few minutes. The first time we really paid attention was 2013, when John Kerry tried to integrate it into his diplomatic activity. So there are options of outside in or bottom up, but what Trump needs to understand, has needed to understand, is that you can't expect success unless you're also doing top down. In other words, you're also doing the hard work of resolving the core issues of the dispute. Some other ideas, confidence-building measures, CBMs, normally thought to be very important in a peace process. How do you instill confidence in the other side that it can trust you, and how do they instill confidence in you? Well, we've learned the hard way in the Arab-Israeli conflict that confidence-building measures in the absence of a peace process, in other words, in the absence of active negotiations, don't work. And they don't work because the sides don't trust each other. And so even when you try to bring about something positive that would send a signal to the other side, it ends up being negative. My favorite example, and there are many, was as we were preparing for the Madrid Peace Conference in 1991, Secretary of State James Baker, I was privileged to serve on his so-called peace team at the time. And so after the conference was announced to take place at the end of October 91, we traveled to Damascus to talk to the Syrians about how they would comport themselves at the conference. And I remember vividly Baker sitting with the then foreign minister, Farouk Ashar. And Baker, they went through a whole list of questions. And one of them was, how will you, Foreign Minister Al-Shara, answer the question, will you shake hands with your Israeli counterpart at the conference? So Baker asked that question, and Shara says, never. I'll never shake the hand of the Zionist enemy. So Baker says, that may not be a good idea to say, coming up to a peace conference. So let's think of alternative ways to answer the question without answering the question. For example, you can answer, look, symbols and handshakes are not important. The important thing is to get to the conference and get to peace. Shara understands this. He goes to a peace conference a few days later, to a press conference a few days later. Second question of the press conference, will you shake hands with the Israeli representative? He goes, never, never with the Zionist enemy. A confidence-building measure that actually might have sent a positive signal, certainly would not have sent a negative signal, turned out to be a confidence destroyer. Status quos are not static. Monitoring what the parties do is important, holding them accountable. In other words, there's a list of lessons learned from the experience that we've had for the last 40 years or more in peacemaking. Not that we've all been that successful. We've had some successes. But those lessons should have been an important part of the education of Mr. Trump and his peace team. In doing his homework, he would have probably wanted to focus on the most recent effort, which was the diplomacy of John Kerry in 2013. And I would argue that in the last 25 years since Madrid, Kerry at least structured his peace process, I think, in the most efficient way possible. Because even before starting to engage the parties, he basically tried to pre-negotiate a number of steps that would accompany, in other words, provide a context for the negotiations that might give them a better chance of success. He brought the Arab foreign ministers back to Washington, and they reaffirmed the Arab Peace Initiative, in fact, with a couple of changes that made it easier for him to try to market it in Israel, which had had some difficulties with some aspects of the initiative. He also revived an effort that had been started under the George W. Bush administration with General James Jones, an effort to try to deal with the implications for Israel of its giving up territory. In other words, if you're going to ask Israel in a peace process to give up significant territory that represents a security asset, how do you deal with that? What offsets it? Is there a way of meeting Israeli security requirements that would allow them to take the decision to withdraw from territory? And so General John Allen, who was the former head of our military in the Middle East, was brought back to do this study, worked very effectively in doing so. It never reached the point where decisions needed to be made, but it was a serious way of sending a signal to the Israelis that we understood their security concerns and were ready to deal with it. As an aside, if any of you is interested, Allen then retired, and as part of a think tank in Washington, the Center for New American Security, he actually published part of his plan. So if you want to delve into the multi-layered effort to try to deal with Israeli security issues, you can see it online at cnas.org. It's a very interesting multi-tiered study. Kerry also understood the importance of creating the conditions for Palestinian economic success. Davos, the World Economic Forum, had proposed a $4 billion investment plan. Kerry associated himself with that. Israeli and Palestinian business people had just gotten together to try to do their own joint projects. Kerry associated himself with that. In other words, he tried to create an environment where peacemaking would work. He then tried to pre-negotiate CBMs, confidence-building measures, that would kick in once the process began. And he asked each side what was most important, and for the Palestinians, the release of what they called old prisoners was the most important single issue. These were prisoners who were in Israeli jails from before the Oslo Accord. So by this time, they had been in jail for 25 years, all for capital offenses. These were not necessarily innocent people, but they'd been in jail for a long time, and for Palestinians, this was an important issue. For Israel, the important issue was the Palestinians avoiding or stopping their effort to gain recognition through international organizations unilaterally, or to take Israel to the International Criminal Court or to the International Court of Justice to try to change this from a negotiation into a legal issue between the two sides. Kerry thought that he had their agreement to do these things, and he then embarked on a prolonged period of trying to negotiate a framework agreement. And so from somewhere around September of 2013 till around March of 2014, the diplomacy focused on that framework agreement against the backdrop of all of these efforts that Kerry had set in motion. The problem, that process failed for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is that the CBMs ended up failing. Remember earlier I said CBMs don't necessarily work in the absence of a serious process. They didn't work this time either. The Israelis balked at releasing the fourth tranche of prisoners because that fourth tranche of prisoners were actually citizens of the State of Israel. And the Israelis say they never agreed to release their own citizens. They were ready to release Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza, but they would not release their own citizens in response to a Palestinian Authority demand. And the Palestinians ran to 14 UN agencies to gain recognition. The process unraveled and failed. Kerry tried one more thing, and this was the other lesson to learn, the homework to do. Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel had been saying for quite some time that it wasn't enough to think about negotiating with the Palestinians. He needed a regional framework. And so Kerry persuaded King Abdullah of Jordan to convene a summit meeting in Aqaba, Jordan, in 2016, attended also by the President of Egypt, to try to work out arrangements, at least maybe a set of principles to govern negotiations. And you'll see as you look at this online, see, I'm giving you homework to do as well. I won't test you on it, you won't get graded, but you are the great class of 54, after all, and you will do your homework. The Kerry principles are logical and reasonable principles, and that summit failed as well. So, again, going into a peace process then, there was a lot to study and a lot to try to derive lessons about for what to do. Now, you recall, I tend to fill up my slides with a lot of stuff. This is one of them. You recall in February of last year, a year ago, Netanyahu visited Washington, and Trump made news by seeming to back away from the two-state solution. For a long time, the idea of the two states as an outcome of negotiations had been part and parcel of American policy. In the press conference with Netanyahu, Trump basically said, one state, two states, whatever the parties agree on. And it threw the process into chaos. Because if the United States wasn't committed to two states, well, what were we committed to? And so in one of my classes, in fact, even before Trump's statement, we developed ideas of what could be alternative outcomes or approaches in the peace process. And there are a lot of them. You can have one state in which Israel presumably would grant full citizenship to Palestinians and take their chances on the demographic balance that Israel believes is needed to preserve the Jewish character of the state. You could have two states. You could have three states. You could have an independent state in Gaza. It's no smaller than some other states in the international system that do quite well through high tech and hard work. You could return to the idea of confederation or federation between a Palestinian entity and Jordan. You could have long-term interim arrangements in which the two sides agree on a set of principles to govern the way they live, but haven't quite reached the point politically where they can make a decision on how to end the conflict. In other words, you have a lot of these alternatives. So I threw this challenge to a bunch of seniors, a bunch of graduate students, I'm sorry. I'm thinking about seniors because of your senior thesis fund, which, you know, it's great stuff. My senior thesis students have been absolutely marvelous, and thank you for supporting them. I threw this problem to my graduate students, and I said, see if you can determine to prove whether or not there is a real viable alternative to a two-state solution that would work. They came up with all of these options, and at the end, they had to admit that none of them worked other than a two-state solution. Not because some of them don't make sense, but politically, on one side or the other, there's not going to be acceptability. So what do you have now? What do you have today? I wrote an article recently in an Israeli paper, which was called "An Emerging One-State Reality." Because you have on the ground, in the absence of movement towards two states, you have on the ground an emerging one-state reality. Israel is continuing to build settlements. There's legislation pending in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, that would extend additional forms of rights and privileges to Israeli citizens living in the West Bank as though they were living in Israel proper. You have further economic ties that are cementing the relationship and preventing the possibility of a Palestinian economy growing organically. And so, in effect, even if you don't say that you're heading towards a one-state outcome, this one-state reality is happening on the ground. To give you one example, I took a group of Princeton students a few years ago as part of our studies to, if any of you have been to the West Bank, there's a hill called Herodion. The King Herod built a fairly significant palace on top of this very prominent hill. And I took them there because you can see from there great distances. And I really wanted to show them two settlements. One was a settlement called Tekoa, and the other is a settlement called Nokdim. And the reason they're important is that they are fairly close to the so-called Green Line, the line that separates Israel and the West Bank, but they have not been included thus far in the discussions on whether or not settlement blocks would be included in the State of Israel in return for some swapped territory. And the reason I took the students there is that the settlers are very, very smart and determined. And what happens is you have Nokdin, you have Tekoa, and over time, they've started to grow in this direction. Why? Because they want to become a bloc, so that if Israel ever does enter into a negotiation in which they're going to give up territory, and the Palestinians agree that they would trade settlement blocks for some territory in Israel, the people of these two settlements want to remain in the State of Israel. One of the most prominent residents of the settlement of Nokdim is the current defense minister of the State of Israel, Avigdor Lieberman. So you can see that even if it isn't a one-state plan, and if you ask both populations, do you want one state, there is still a majority against the idea in both constituencies. Reality on the ground is changing, which means that there's a certain imperative to get working on the so-called ultimate deal. Now, we don't know what's in that ultimate deal. But from newspaper reporting and conversations, including, as you heard, I spent 3 days this week mostly in Ramallah talking to the Palestinians. President Mahmoud Abbas will be addressing the UN Security Council on Tuesday, and it seemed to be a propitious time to go and think out loud, do a little brainstorming on what he might say that is far more positive than the last speech he gave, which was absolutely awful. It was a tremendous setback in the peace process and really raised questions about whether or not Abbas is a serious partner. So the question was, could he undo some of the damage and give a better speech? And in the course of these discussions, we have an outline, at least I think we have an outline of what Trump is thinking about. And it's basically a plan that is very heavily weighted in Israel's favor. Now, we know from early December when he decided to say that Israel's capital was Jerusalem, making no mention of Palestinian aspirations to have their own capital in Jerusalem, a throwaway line that said, well, we don't take a position on the ultimate determination of borders. And then he says he's taken Jerusalem off the table. This is what drove the Palestinians nuts. Jerusalem is quite important to them. We know that he's trying to take refugees off the table now. An Israeli diplomat admitted as much to me in the course of a conference in Washington just 2 weeks ago. So the deal that Trump seems to be heading towards, and again, we don't know for sure, is a deal that is fated to fail the moment that it is unveiled. Because it may be quite, it may make Prime Minister Netanyahu quite happy. It's going to make the Palestinians and frankly the Arabs exceedingly unhappy. And so even if there is a closer strategic relationship emerging between Trump and President al-Sisi of Egypt and King Salman of Saudi Arabia, for strategic reasons, largely related to our common antagonism toward Iran and Iranian policies, if this kind of deal emerges as Trump's preferred outcome, it will throw the Middle East into a very serious tizzy. So the last thing I want to leave you with before we open up to some questions and comments, what could be done? If Trump really wanted to do smart policy, I sometimes call this my Ten Commandments. You know, it is the Middle East, after all. Ten Commandments are an appropriate thing to think about. Some of you may have seen the Mel Brooks film, The History of the World, Part 1, where Moses goes up and you see him come down from the mountain with three tablets. And he says, oh, people of Israel, I brought you 15. And then one of the tablets falls. He says, 10 commandments. So I could do 15, but we'll do 10. These are 10 things that require significant American leadership and significant American backbone. Because the parties themselves are simply not going to do them. The parties themselves, if they do go to negotiations, never go to negotiations on the basis of agreed terms of reference. And so they walk in, and if you happen to have leaders who want to make an agreement, so they start the negotiations kind of here. When they don't want to make an agreement, they start the negotiations from there, because there are no terms of reference. President Clinton, back in 2000, actually came out with American parameters, terms of reference, which the parties used for a few years to try to negotiate. It's time to renew that and to update that. And we have an idea, especially from Kerry's effort and from the effort in 2008 when Prime Minister Olmert of Israel and President Abbas were negotiating, we have an idea about kind of where the parties are. And so we could create parameters or terms of reference that narrow the scope of the negotiations. We don't determine outcomes, but we say to the parties, don't start here. You're not going to get anywhere. Start here, and then we'll try to head you down the kind of funnel and help you bridge your differences. It might be useful, the second idea is to take those parameters and put them into a UN Security Council resolution. The governing resolution of this peace process, the internationally governing resolution, is Resolution 242. It was adopted on November 22nd, 1967. Okay? You were already out of school, 13 years by that time. You're talking a long time ago. It's 52 years. My math is right. Eh? I'm a political scientist, so if my math is wrong, tell me. You need to update the terms of reference for negotiations. So if you have strong parameters, you bring them to the Security Council, and you say to the parties, okay, look, if you're ready to negotiate on the basis of these terms of reference, that's great. If you're not, understand that this is now the internationally legitimized basis for negotiations. Then you have a bunch of other ideas. Some of them would be acceptable, some not. The Palestinians are demanding that the United States not be the sole mediator. They want to see an international mediation. Well, we already have a quartet that's been in operation since about 2002, involving the U.S., Russia, the European Union, and the United Nations. It could be expanded. You could include the so-called Arab Quartet of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, and the United Arab Emirates. You can install a monitoring system, which we've never had, and which has been the cause of some very significant problems in the Middle East, where you don't follow or take action when the parties don't do what they say they're going to do, or they do things they say they promise not to do. And so the process erodes as a result of a failure of monitoring, accountability, and any kind of consequences, and a range of other issues. In other words, if you want to do the ultimate deal, number one, you have to do homework, and you have to figure out what is it that didn't go right in the past, what did go right, and what might be alternatives. Number two, you have to study the environment, the context in which this process is going to take place, because the parties are all going to have reference to that environment in making their own decisions. And number three, you can't treat this as a real estate deal. You have to take hard decisions. You have to be willing to stand up to some Arab pressures. You have to be able to stand up to Israeli pressures. And so far, as my final word, this president has not been willing to do that kind of hard work. And as a result, the chances, the possibilities of actually moving towards that ultimate deal are no stronger today than they were when he took office. Final word is a footnote, since I was just in Palestine, Israel this week. Prime Minister Netanyahu is in deep trouble, as you've seen in the press coverage here. There are actually four legal cases against him. The police have now recommended that he be indicted on the first two of these. I've been told by a number of people that the fourth of the cases is actually the most explosive. It involves the Bezeq telecommunications company and favors that the prime minister did in his other hat as the minister of communications to benefit a friend who is a major stockholder in the company. The chances of his being indicted are exceedingly high, but it's going to take time because the system in Israel requires that the attorney general go through a number of steps before making a decision. And even though just yesterday the attorney general said that he will not shy away from making that decision, we're talking about months, and there's a lot of time for stuff to happen between now and the moment of indictment, including an unveiling of a Trump initiative that Netanyahu can use to political advantage, including calling early elections in Israel. So in Yogi Berra fashion, it ain't over till it's over. But watch this space, because the leadership issue in Israel is only going to get more complicated. The second problem, or second priority in Israel, of course, is what's happening in Syria. We can talk about that in the Q&A. This issue of the Palestinian issue in Israel doesn't figure on the national agenda right now. So that's another reason not to be optimistic about the possibility of actually getting to negotiations. Thank you very much. Sir.
Won't the imminence of Netanyahu's denouement cause him to step back or change the situation?
I'm sorry, the imminence of what?
The imminence of Netanyahu's
Knowing Mr. Netanyahu as I do, because I did work with him, he was the finance minister when I was ambassador, and I worked with him earlier in his previous incarnation as prime minister, and he was deputy foreign minister before that. He's going to fight like hell and not going to step down. In fact, he has spent the last 72 hours marshaling the arguments of fake news, the police are corrupt. It's very much a kind of, you remember the Austin Powers movies, Mini-Me? It's a little bit of Trumpism channeled in Israeli politics, discrediting the investigation, discrediting the investigators, and trying to mobilize his own base. The public opinion polling in Israel is suggesting that he may be having some success. About 40% of the Israeli public, which is his base, are saying that he should not step down. And even though you say, well, 60% or more than 50% would suggest that he does step down, Israel is a coalition-based political system. And he still controls the largest party in the Knesset. So chances of his stepping down, absent some major defections on the part of his coalition partners, is very small. And so far, he's lined up the critical coalition partners to say that he should stay in office. Now, the Israeli legal system requires a minister to leave office when he or she is indicted. It doesn't say that the prime minister must leave office. So there's going to be a question, even if he's indicted, whether or not he decides to stay on at that point. But I'm not a really betting person anyway, but I certainly would not put a bet on an early departure of Mr. Netanyahu from office without a really bloody fight in the political system.
And he can be successfully operating under that cloud?
This is the big question. The argument of those who want him to step down is he's spending so much time dealing with his legal problems, and his mind is so occupied with those legal problems, how could he possibly handle affairs of state? What's interesting, and it's all over the Israeli press, you remember Ehud Olmert was indicted in 2008. Before he was indicted, the Israeli police recommended indictment, which is the same situation as you have now, recommendation of indictment. And Netanyahu had a great quote at that time saying, how can a prime minister stay in power even under the threat of a possibility of indictment? He can't focus on the affairs of state. That was Netanyahu talking about Olmert. Well, you know, that was then and this is now, and I'm not Olmert, you know, that kind of thing. So, no, I don't think so. Yeah.
Yes, I'm very curious why there are countries that are so wealthy, don't open doors for the refugees that are coming all over the world and Europe anymore. Take it. Why doesn't anybody just really press for them to open the doors to the people that are so much the same background?
Well, first of all, two Arab states have opened their doors, not necessarily voluntarily, but simply because the refugees have poured into them. Jordan is now home to who knows how many, over a million Syrian refugees, and Lebanon has been inundated. Jordan has also absorbed, as you know, many Palestinian refugees over the years, and Iraqi refugees after the 2003 war. So it's not entirely accurate to say that the Arab states have not opened their doors. But it is accurate to say the Arab world has certainly not done enough to try to deal with the larger refugee issue, including in funding mechanisms. You know, the United States recently cut some of our funding to the UN agency that helps Palestinian refugees. And the first country to try to fill the gap was Belgium. You know, it wasn't Saudi Arabia, and it wasn't the Emirates, and it wasn't Kuwait, and it wasn't the oil-rich countries. It was one of the European countries. So there's no question that they should be doing more, and there's been no consequence for their failure to do. Yeah.
Ambassador, I'm active in an organization called Israel Policy Forum.
I know them well. And I know the American Jewish Committee well as also. Yeah. That was a shout out to Mr. Rinkin. Yeah.
So the Israel Policy Forum is working together with an interesting group called the Commanders for Israel Security, which is like 270 right. Retired IDF generals who are really advocating for what I think you and I would advocate for, which is a secure, democratic, and Jewish state. It's been frustrating for me to see how little advance they are making within the Israeli populace. Because to me, when you have 80% of your, you know, your heroes and former generals advocating against what the current government is doing, advocating for two states, that the Israeli populace just doesn't grab. I would be interested to get your assessment of what you think the possibility is for the commanders to gain more popular support? Or to tell us why you think it can't happen?
You know, it's a great question, and I don't know the answer as to why it hasn't had more resonance in the Israeli public. After all, these are the same people that the population has relied upon to defend them for their own careers, 30, 40 years in the security services and the military. They come out and they join an organization that says, you know, we did our service, we protected the state, and we're now telling you based on our experience that we have to make peace with Palestinians. That's critically important to be done. And it doesn't resonate in the public, and I don't know why. I was at a conference probably 7 or 8 years ago in Jerusalem, and I was sitting between Dori Gold, who was a former advisor to Netanyahu on one side, and the late Mayor Dagan, who was a 40-year veteran of the Israeli army, 8 years as head of the Mossad, the Israeli CIA. Gold, who has published a lot on this subject, said Israel can never give up the West Bank because it would lead Israel to have indefensible borders. And he has an argument about the hilltops and the valley and invasion routes. It's not an argument without enough merit to be studied. He finishes his presentation and then turns to Dagan. And Dagan says, look, I spent 40 years defending this state. And I'll tell you, bottom line, is if you tell me where the border is as a result of the negotiated settlement, we'll defend it. I might want a little bit more. I might want a bigger hilltop. I might want to be a little bit. But if you tell me where the border is, we'll defend it. He says, we defended it in 67 when we had the borders that were not very comfortable. We didn't defend it as well in 73 when we thought the borders were more defensible. But whatever you tell us the borders are, number one. Number two, he said, what people like Dori Gold ignore and what the Israeli public ignores when they hear these generals talk is the fact that guarantee of peace or security in peace is not only a reflection of the balance of power and the status of the arms in each side, it's also political will. And Dagan said, if you have a border that is now governed by a peace treaty, where there's a party on the other side responsible for maintaining the security of that border, that's worth its weight in gold. Okay, so you have a politician, or let's say a policy analyst, versus a 40-year general, and people don't pay much attention to him. Can that change? I don't know. Part of it may be public relations. How do the generals get their point across to a population that expects them to do their work, and then maybe to shut up, and they're not shutting up. But how do you get that point across where it's credible to that population is a mystery right now.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And one more, Ambassador Pelletier.
Yeah.
This is the dangerous question.
Yeah. Dan, it's been wonderful to listen to you, being so on top of the issues, traveling to the region, talking with the leaders, coming back to teach tomorrow's leaders at Princeton, and speak to influential groups like this. One, we hope you're not a voice in the wind. First point. Second point, you have been involved on one side or another to U.S. assistance to the Palestinians over the years in various forms, through UNRWA, through USAID, through other sources. And Mr. Trump has threatened to terminate all that assistance, and half of the assistance to UNRWA has been suspended. In your view, how important is U.S. assistance to the Palestinians? How do the Israelis feel about U.S. assistance to the Palestinians? What would happen if Trump follows through on his threats to terminate it all?
It's a great question, because one of the consistent counterintuitive issues here is that whenever there has been a threat to assistance to the Palestinians, even when the Israelis say they support it, they then will lobby quietly in Washington to maintain it. The simple reason being that if it's not provided by the international community, it becomes their responsibility as the occupying power. And we now know, you can read almost every day reports about the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza. That pressure cooker could explode at any point. They just shut down yesterday or the day before the Gaza power station, because not only has Israel cut off supplies because they haven't gotten paid, but the Egyptians have also cut off supplies. The Egyptians are complicit in this pressure being put on the Palestinians in Gaza. So it's far more complicated than simply saying, as you see administration spokespeople say, well, UNRWA shouldn't exist, Palestinian refugees should be folded into the UN Office of the High Commissioner of Refugees, there are too many refugees on the books, inconsistent with international norms with respect to refugees. That's good political jargon, but it makes no sense on the ground. If you don't provide this necessary humanitarian support, you're going to pay the same price later in dealing with the consequences of conflict. And if you want a case study, look at 2014, where a devastating war took place. The population in Israel south largely either had to leave or to go underground because of rocket fire and the threat of infiltration through tunnels. Population in Gaza was under major bombardment because of Hamas's aggressive policies, and it left Gaza in shambles, and it has to be fixed. So either you figure out a way to solve the underlying conflict and create a Palestinian economy that can take care of its own people, or you have to, these people are going to be on the dole, and that's really the choice that we face now. My guess is that the UNRWA threat is going to prove to be an empty threat, because, you know, short term, Belgium and a couple of others may fill in the gap, but there are a lot of refugees in the world and a lot more pressing needs in some respects than Palestinians. And the pie is only so large. It may grow a little bit with more additional aid. But at some point, I think we're going to have to come back and pick up that slack for our own interests, not out of even an altruistic motivation. Yeah.
One more, if I may. What do you see to be Israel's interest in the Syrian conflict now? Is it simply defensive, or is there an offensive element with regard to Iran and the Hezbollah?
Yeah. So you're going to have to invite me back, because this is a whole story. Look, in brief, since the outbreak of the conflict in 2011, Israel basically has taken a hands-off until recently, and the reason was, they have no particular love for Bashar al-Assad, but the border between Syria and the occupied Golan Heights has been the quietest border in the Middle East since 1974. So even if they don't particularly like Assad, they had no reason to come in either in support of him or in opposition to him, number one. Number two, there was no other motivation to get involved until, and now we're getting into the more recent period, until it became clear that Iran's efforts to save the Bashar al-Assad regime brought along with it the ensconcement in Syria of Iranian proxy elements and some Iranian military elements themselves. For Israel, this now becomes a significant security threat, with the possibility of having a security challenge on its northern border with Hezbollah in Lebanon, now becoming a security challenge on its Golan Heights border with Iranian-supported militias and Hezbollah as well, which has been fighting. And so Israel, months ago, started to make clear that it would see Iran's presence in, not necessarily in all of Syria, but certainly in the area, let's say, between Damascus and the Golan Heights, which is not, it's maybe 70, 60 miles, something like that. It would see that as a significant enough threat to take action. And therefore, the level of Israeli military activity has grown quite dramatically and rapidly. We were told publicly by the just retired head of the Israeli Air Force, General Amir Eshel, that over the past couple of years, Israel has conducted 100 airstrikes in Syria. Nobody paid attention because those strikes were focused on Iranian rearmament of Hezbollah. And they've been going on for many years. Iran sends planes through Damascus Airport to Hezbollah. When Israel finds out about them, it tries to hit those targets and try to disrupt the supply line. But there's now a difference because Israel is taking military action essentially to deter and push back Iranian influence, not just the resupply of Hezbollah. And this is why the temperature has gone up so significantly. You saw this past week the Iranian proxies launched a drone. It came into Israeli airspace, was shot down. The Israeli Air Force destroyed what the newspapers are saying is almost 50% of Syria's air defense system. And that brought the Russians into the game because they don't want the Syrian regime weakened enough that Bashar al-Assad's regime is in jeopardy. So the complexity of the Syrian situation now has a new player. I don't have it, but there's a wonderful graphic that tried to explain what everybody who is doing in Syria. And it looks like one of those abstract paintings where you take paint and you throw it. The connections are extraordinary, and now Israel is one of those players for the particular reason of denying Iran and its proxies as well as Hezbollah a foothold that would present a more difficult challenge than just dealing with Hezbollah along the northern border. Okay. Thanks.